you're running a business in Canada right now, you're playing a game where the rules keep changing. Trade tensions, economic uncertainty, shifting policies. It's clear that what happens in America doesn't always stay in America. What's happening right now is reshaping industries, disrupting supply chains, and forcing Canadian companies, whether they operate cross-border or not, to adapt faster than ever. That's why our show is evolving. Welcome to Mission Critical, the podcast where we break down the blueprints, the bold moves, and the battle-tested playbooks of today's most impactful leaders. From CEOs and founders to artists, designers, and athletes, we're talking to the visionaries who build, innovate, and lead. Because behind every great company, every groundbreaking idea, and every game-changing innovation, there's a leader on a mission. I'm Lance Chung, and this is Mission Critical. Let's get into it. What does it take to build a mega successful brand in Canada? If you ask Joanna Griffiths, the answer isn't just innovation, it's disruption. As the founder of Knix, the Canadian brand known for its leak-proof underwear, she challenged the status quo by turning a taboo topic into a global movement, reshaping the entire industry while staying fiercely independent. That is until she made one of the biggest exits in Canadian history. In 2022, Knix closed a deal for an 80% stake in its business to Swedish company Essity for a whopping $320 million. The deal marked the highest private sale of a direct-to-consumer company from a female founder in Canadian history, with Joanna retaining the remaining 20% as president of the brand. But success at this level isn't just about the bold ideas. It's really about resilience. And Joanna's journey is a masterclass in standing your ground when it matters most. She fundraised while pregnant, turning down investors who didn't see her worth by setting her own quote-unquote asshole filter, which you'll later see in this episode. And she's shepherded her company through some really tough times. Times like the one we're in now. With rising costs, shifting consumer behavior, and a Canada-US trade war throwing new obstacles in the way literally every day, how does a company built on inclusivity and community, and with a significant base in America, continue to thrive? Beyond that, as a brand that has built itself on empowerment, what do you do as a founder during the Ozempic era and ever-changing beauty standards? Has the industry quietly moved on from celebrating real bodies? And what does that mean for a brand like hers? This episode is about more than business. It's about power, influence, and what it really takes to lead in an era of disruption. If you're an entrepreneur, a leader, or just someone trying to make sense of the shifting cultural landscape, you won't want to miss this conversation. Buckle up. This one's important. Hi, Joanna.
Hi. Nice
How
to
are
see
you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Good. I'm good. So happy to be chatting with you. I feel like it's kind of surprising that this is like the first time we're chatting in person for an interview, because I have followed your story throughout, and like the Toronto kind of entrepreneurial ecosystem is also a very small community, and like we featured Knix in different ways, but this is like the first time we're actually talking IRL, and it's a long time coming. I agree.
Yeah, I guess I've been in hiding.
Well, and like just busy building an incredible business, and your office is stunning. We're here, and it's what I want our office to look like at some point, but it's beautiful. Thank you for having
me. You're
us.
So welcome. Yeah, it's great to be here.
Okay, so you know, as we all know, you're the founder and the president of Knix. If you had to explain Knix in just kind of like one sentence to someone who's like never heard of it before, what would you say, and how do you, would you say that it's changed since you founded it back in 2012?
So I would describe Knix as an intimate swimwear and activewear brand. And our mission is to enable people to be unapologetically free. So we really try to reinvent what products can mean for people, and create a brand that really recognizes and celebrates women for who they are. How has that changed? Well, I think the swimwear activewear piece has been added over the past several years. The mission piece has been pretty much the same from the very, very beginning. So really this idea to like create a brand that really spoke to people, and that celebrated them, and to create products in a different way. So I think, the categories have changed. The assignment is still the same.
And you talk about freedom too, and that means different things to
it
different
does.
People, right?
Yeah.
How do you kind of, I guess, empower people to, you know, utilize that notion of freedom through the lens of Knix?
I think it has to do a lot with letting go of the things that you can't control, and honoring and celebrating who you are as an individual and as a person exactly as you are. And so I think you know, when I grew up, it was the height of Victoria's Secret. It was the height of mainstream media. It was the height of so many different things. And there was just like such a singular view of what beauty looked like and such a singular view of what was acceptable. Mm. And I think at that point in time, and I'm curious if it's like similar for you or if this is more of like a gender thing, but the most aspirational thing in the world was to be thin, to be rich, and to be beautiful. And I think that at NYX, we believe the most aspirational thing is to like and accept yourself exactly as you are.
Yeah.
And there's something that's so incredibly empowering when you meet a person who lives their life that way. Mm-hmm. Like there's like a confidence and there's an energy that's just contagious.
Yeah. Yeah. I have noticed, you know, a shift over the years in that, you know, back in that kind of Victoria's Secret, like America's Next Top Model kind of like whole era.
Yes.
It was kind of like the era of like the idol and the idolization and the people that you kind of like would idolize, whether it's like a model on the catwalk. But now it feels a lot more democratized and the focus and the spotlight is on the consumers or the community, I guess.
Yeah.
And the diversity that comes with that.
I think we've come a long way, from those days. I even look back at shows like Grey's Anatomy or like some of the Shonda Rhimes shows that she created and how, you know, different they were at the time because they featured casts that like actually looked like and represented the kinds of things that you would actually see at a hospital or you'd see in an office. And mm-hmm. so, you know, it's funny to think about how far we've come, and it's almost breaks your brain to think about how long we stayed in the same place for.
Totally. When you started NYX, because, you know, the company has really established itself as a category leader and an industry leader, but back in, like, when you first started, or even before you started it, what was kind of the one problem in the industry that you were most determined to solve?
Yeah.
What was that pain point?
That was the idea to make leak-proof underwear or period underwear. So it was this recognition that leaks are like a real thing that almost every person experiences, and there hadn't been like a big innovation in that space in a really long time, and mm-hmm. wanting to create a problem that addressed that specific pain point. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a taboo topic. It was a completely different kind of product from what existed at the time. It was like a white space. And I think when you're trying to like change the way that people approach an everyday habit or a certain behavior that they have, and you're trying to like get folks to talk about something that they've historically not felt comfortable talking about because of shame and stigma, you have to create a different kind of brand mm-hmm. to kind of create the space for that.
Yeah, I guess that's interesting, because when you are going into like uncharted waters mm-hmm. in a white space, in what ways did you see that as an opportunity to really, you know, there's not really a precedent, so you can kind of play within it, but also as, you know, obviously there are hurdles to that if there has been no track record of it being done before.
I think that the opportunity is that like the sky's the limit. And I worked on NYX while I was at a MBA school called INSEAD, and they're best known for what's called Blue Ocean Strategy. And so it's the idea that some of the most disruptive business ideas are created in a blue ocean. So you're not actually surrounded by competition. You're not having to differentiate on like price or those different things. You're in kind of a league all of their own. Mm-hmm. And I remember doing a case study, and actually one of the brands we studied in Blue Ocean Strategy was Cirque du Soleil. And just how, you know, who were they competing with? Were they competing with the circus? No, not really, because no one really went to the circus anymore. You know, were they competing with live theater? Kind of, but it was such a different kind of experience. And so the idea behind, you know, going out on your own and into your own space means that there's really kind of no limit to what you can accomplish. The scary part about it is there's no playbook.
Right.
Like you can't say, oh, they did it this way and let's go copy the way that they did it. Mm-hmm. You can't like put into ChatGPT, you know, show me how people are marketing these products, because no one's marketing that product, you know? So I think that's kind of like the scary part. Mm-hmm. But I have to tell you, like, one of the most liberating feelings I've had over the course of building NYX is when I realized that like no one else knows what to do either.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Right. There's almost something that's really freeing about that idea, being like, well, we're just gonna make it up.
Yeah.
And anyone else in our situation would be making it up, and so like, why not us?
Everyone's just trying to figure it out.
We're all just trying to figure it out. Yeah.
The other thing too is that, you know, what works at one point in time may not work at another point in time because culture changes, business changes, everything, you know, shifting sands. So it's not even to say that even if there was a precedent that it would apply necessarily to the landscape that the culture kind of is reflecting.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, even that notion of like not having competition and creating a product in a space that's like so differentiated. I mean, that's no longer the case for us at NYX. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like the marketing that we at one point, you know, started with and continue to do, but that was seen as like so disruptive and so different from what everyone had seen before, now has become kind of table stakes by a lot of the brands in our space, including Victoria's Secret, right?
Yeah.
The product that we created, Leak Proof Underwear, that had no competition, now there's dupes everywhere. You know, if you search on Amazon, there's probably 100 knockoff brands.
Yeah.
And so you do have to continuously pivot or evolve and kind of shift your strategy and make sure that you're really like being true to who you are as a brand and the DNA that you've created.
Do you find that almost like in some ways like a sense of validation when there are other brands that are trying to emulate the same thing?
I do. I definitely do. And I think when you're, you know, like I mentioned, when you're trying to change the way that a consumer approaches a habit or a way of solving a problem. So in our case, when we're trying to get women to think differently about their periods, as an example, and they've probably been using the same products for a decade, two decades, they've thought about it the same way. There's actually power in having more than one brand be marketing to you. And so, you know, NYX, like we're such an interesting example of this, I think, where the same year that that we were acquired and sold 80% of the business, our two largest competitors were acquired at the same time too.
Interesting.
And that's like so rare when you take like the top three brands in a space and all of them have an exit at the same time. You see it in food and beverage more than you see it in like this kind of consumer good, if that makes sense.
And I guess, you know, when you do have complementary competitors in the kind of same space, overall, the dialogue around your space, there's more people talking
more
about
people
it,
more talking people talking about
engaging
it.
With
it.
So, you know, in some way, there's more awareness around the category.
Exactly.
Too.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, I think it's also sort of rare to see a category like ours has gone where, you know, a decade ago this didn't really exist, no one knew what it was, and now you have like one in three women have tried it, you know, over 10 years. Like that's pretty fast adoption, right? Yeah.
Did you find that there was a hurdle to getting?
Still.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
And is that more of like an educational kind of, or just breaking?
It's funny, it's like been a decade, but the questions are always the same questions that there were 5 years ago.
Right.
I think it's just having people kind of wrap their heads around, how does it work? How do I wear it? How do I wash it? Is it gross? You know, like there's just like a bunch of questions that are the same questions.
Yeah.
Not much has changed in that regard, which
That's
is really
interesting. Yeah. But I guess, like those kinds of, you know, rituals and these things that are kind of in some ways passed down generationally in terms of like habits and stuff, those are not always the easiest to break.
No, super, like very challenging.
Yeah, exactly. Very interesting. How did you initially kind of validate the idea that there was a demand for the product category? And not just that, but also the idea around shifting the focus around body positivity in an era where, you know, the dominant narrative was very different.
Yeah. So I think the idea for the first product, I did a lot of research. I did a lot of, the like techie word for it's called digital anthropology, but it was really just like online creeping and research and like getting people to talk to me about these things. And the stats were staggering. Like the, you know, the issue of leaks that we're talking about, 80% of people who menstruate have leaks on their period. 80%. That's massive. You know, one in three, a minimum of one in three women experience light leaks. Mm-hmm. And so, like, the numbers were there. What was kind of more astonishing to me was that the solutions weren't there. So it's like, okay, there's these big problems that people are facing every single day, and why hasn't anyone tried to do this? And I remember also being back at school and realizing that the sexiest problems get solved first. And I was kind of trying to solve a pretty unsexy problem. And so sometimes those things get overlooked, you know?
Even if it applies to half the population.
Yeah, exactly. And then you start looking at the dynamics of the intimates or lingerie landscape, and the majority of brands and companies were run by men. Mm-hmm. And so they're not designing products specifically for women, thinking about their bodies, how they feel. You know, a lot of the products, I like to say, were being designed to be worn for 5 minutes, and then ideally someone takes it off of you, right? So to come in and think about, you know, what if we made things that people wanted to wear all day was just in and of itself quite different. And then the brand piece, honestly, we kind of stumbled into that one. So as we, since we started the business, we've always fit on every product on every size we make, which again, this does not happen in the apparel industry at all, let alone the lingerie industry.
Right.
And what I found when we were fitting the products was that it was looking good on everyone. And so I, you know, had always had a hard time online shopping and like just picturing myself in what it would look like on me. Mm-hmm. And so we just started posting photos of the products on every size that we made. And we got such positive feedback from that. And then we kept doing it. And pretty quickly heard from people just how like refreshingly different that was. To actually go and look at an item and see someone that looks like you in it and be able to envision what it would be like on yourself. Mm. And so we kept doing it. And I think, you know, in hindsight, it was creating the brand that I so badly wish existed when I was growing up.
Yeah. It's wild that, you know, just trying to be inclusive and representing the community was a revolutionary
notion. It was. I mean, when we launched that, like, you know, See It in Every Size We Make campaign, we launched it the same week that the Lululemon see-through legging debacle happened.
Oh my gosh.
Literally the same week.
Wow.
And you have, you know, one brand coming at it saying, look how good this product looks on everybody. Like, why don't you see for yourself? And you have another brand coming at it saying, like, our product isn't the problem. People are trying to switch themselves into this brand and that's the problem, you know? So it was just like this moment where the path seemed so clear to me, but it was a rejection of how it was being done at the time.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah.
You know, in the early days, Nix had a really successful crowdfunding campaign. What did that kind of part of the journey teach you about your customers and your market, and ultimately kind of help you shape the business or the foundation of the business at the time?
Yeah. So I think, you know, if you're launching a consumer brand or product in 2013, you're probably doing a crowdfunding campaign. Mm-hmm. I just feel like that's what everybody did.
Yeah.
Do you remember that era at all or not really?
All the time.
Yeah. It was just like the height of Kickstarter and Indiegogo and these platforms.
Yep.
And so, we learned so much from doing it that way and avoided, I think, a ton of costly mistakes and actually were able to launch a product with a lot of early feedback from customers. I mean, I still remember putting our video, like launching our campaign, and we'd been working on this concept for, at that point, probably almost 2 years. And identifying very quickly that we'd been way too prescriptive about what the product did. So a lot of customers were like, can I use it for this? Can I use it for this? Like, I want to buy this, but I like don't leak, but I sweat, and you know, just all these different things. And so we very quickly like took down the video, reshot it, repositioned everything, and kind of threw out the playbook that we'd been working on for the first, you know, 2 years to get ready to launch, just because customers so clearly were showing us that we'd gotten it wrong. So there's something so cool about doing those campaigns because you learn a lot.
Yeah.
And I think what I learned from that we still, you know, do to this day is like, it's actually really great to involve your customers in the product development process throughout the whole way.
And when it comes to, listening to your audience and your customers. I've noticed just kind of going through, having known the brand and just going through the site and the product descriptions, that Nyx is also like super intentional about the wording that you all use in terms of, in terms of how gender is considered.
Yeah.
And so has that been a result of the feedback that you've gotten from your consumers, or just in terms of your overall goals around inclusivity and just trying to?
I think, you know, specifically around gendered language, a lot of that push came internally from our teams. And so I think there's a certain kind of person that's drawn to work at Nyx, and they have a very clear set of values and beliefs, and then push us to adhere to them, if that makes sense. And so we, wherever possible, do try to avoid gendered language. We try to obviously like be inclusive in terms of our marketing. I mean, that we've been doing since the dawn of time, so that's sort of been part of it. But there's like no one gatekeeper at Nyx that's driving this, and I think that's something that's so cool. It's like you create a culture and an ecosystem where the teams are the ones that put it forward.
Right.
I love that.
So it's listening to consumers, but also just like internal
And internally. I mean, the people internally are customers too most of the time, you know?
Right.
I think it's like a very, very interesting time to see, because in so many ways we've like made a ton of progress, I think, in terms of inclusivity and DEI. But then now we're at a moment where like so much of it is being walked back, you know? And so I'm just like so curious about how this is all gonna play out.
Yeah, it is a very interesting time right now, for sure.
Yeah.
And I did actually want to touch on just kind of the culture of kind of DEI that we're kind of in right now. But kind of going back to the early days still, what were some of the hardest operational challenges that you faced, you know, when you were scaling it from a startup to
I think finding someone to make it was the first hard challenge. Especially having no background in design or physical products and creating something that like didn't exist. A lot of manufacturing partners just did not know what to do with me. And the first few samples we got were some of the most hideous creations you've seen in your life. And so, you know, I think that was the first challenge. The second challenge I encountered, I think, as a founder was really identifying that there's so many different decisions that you have to make. And there's like, for every decision, it's almost like you're picking a new puzzle piece.
Right.
So, you know, any name a decision. What color should we make? What fulfillment center should we work with? What manufacturing companies should be our vendor? What platform should we build our site on?
Yeah.
And each one that you, each decision you make starts kind of like shaping the business into something else. And so I think like witnessing that journey, you know, and then realizing like sometimes early on you make decisions about one of those pieces and it's just, it doesn't work once you scale or you start growing.
Right.
And so once I started to figure that out, I think we've done like a way better job of picking partners, picking platforms, picking tools that can really grow and scale with us. And so a lot of the people that we work with now, we've worked with for the last 10 years, which is
great.
Super interesting. Yeah.
And those are relationships.
Yeah, exactly. We had our 10th anniversary party in our office. Gosh, when was that? Like a year and a half ago, probably.
Yeah.
And people were people were shocked that it was like a corporate 10th anniversary party. Like everybody stayed so late. Everyone was like hugging and loving each other. And you know what I mean? And it was just like, it was all kinds of people. It was like the people that run our warehouse to like the folks from Shopify to, you know, the marketing, the photographers we've worked with for the better part of the last several years. And I think it's because we really feel like this is a brand that's been like co-created with the people around us.
You know, for a long time you kept Nyx independent before it was acquired. What was the tipping point that made you realize that that was the right time for a change like that?
So I think the The interesting thing about it is that I absolutely was not looking to sell, to find a partner to sell. Right. So we just closed a private equity round and brought on new partners. I think, you know, the way that the story goes, or it happened in my life, it's not even a story, the way my life went, is we closed our private equity round on a Friday, gave birth to my twin daughters on the Monday, and on the Tuesday while I was still in hospital, SDR Partners, who ended up acquiring the business, reached out to me.
Wow.
And they were like, are you interested? And I was like, your timing could not be worse.
Like, she was busy.
I was like, I just raised $50 million, I just had two babies, and I'm still here. But I just really liked them. And I really liked that we share as a company like super similar values. Even mm-hmm. their mission, which is unlocking barriers to health and well-being, is super similar to ours. And what they saw in Nyx was the potential to create like a category-defining brand that would be around for generations. Mm-hmm. And so when you find someone who shares that vision, and you get along with them, it's kind of hard to say no to, if that makes sense.
Well, and this is the thing too, is that like for a lot of businesses, the idea of you know, exiting or being acquired and just being able to have those opportunities and have someone come to you, to, you know, it sounds so tempting, but if it's not the right partner, then it's like, that could be a whole other thing. And you know, a lot of, people have seen your story in terms of your experience fundraising while you were pregnant and kind of the policy that you set for yourself to, in terms of what, who you would like to work with and why. And so how did that, I guess, or I guess what are your, what's your perspective and advice for other founders in terms of understanding who to work with and whether it's an investor or a partner?
I think, you know, someone gave me this advice early on, and it is true. It's like, easier to get divorced than it is to break up with an investor. And so it's always encouraging folks to be as disciplined as possible and as protective as possible about who they let on their cap table and who you choose to surround yourself as a founder. And so for a long time for me, that meant saying no to a lot of money because it just didn't make sense. They weren't necessarily the right partners. And when I would make, you know, pros and cons lists about why I was raising money, honestly, the number one reason was ego, and it had nothing to do with the business. And so I think I just, for a long time, was like very, very protective about who I let around the business. And the output of that meant that I had like a very core group of investors and people around me who believed in me, who were extremely supportive, who always pushed me to trust my intuition. And so I think when I went out to do our private equity round, and it was a bit of a different process. We worked with an investment banker. I, you know, I think in one, the first day I did like 40 meetings or something like that. Like you're really speed dating and, and getting out there. And the feedback came from a few folks that they, you know, were uncertain if I could build a company and have all these babies and, you know, just like, was I going to take the money and run, and like a whole bunch of things being said. And I just looked at that moment, and it's like, just because I've hired an investment bank to help me with this doesn't mean that I should approach it any different than I would myself, which is stay true to your values, have an asshole filter, try to really be protective about who you let around the business, and make sure that they're the kinds of people where if things are going well, you want to look across the table at them and align on a strategy. And if things are going poorly, you want to look across the table at them and align on the strategy and know that they have the company's best interest at heart. So I think it's so important. And I think, you know, money's a really interesting thing. Like the power dynamic is fascinating. But when I look at that dynamic of the money changing hands, actually, like, you know, just to put it in the simplest terms, it's like I'm the horse that they're betting on, and I'm the one that can turn that money into like 10 times what it was. And so I actually have a lot more say in this than I would necessarily think. You know,
that's like a shift of perspective.
Of perspective, you know, like, yes, I'm going to take this money, and you gave it to me, and that's incredible. But then, like, I'm the one that's going to have to show up every single day and work my ass off to make sure that you get the return that you want. And you only really want to do that for good people. like, it doesn't feel good to work that hard and to do it for people who aren't, like, deep down in their core good.
Yeah. You also had a similar experience. I was listening to some interviews that you've done on Dragon's Den, where you turned down the dragon that offered the most money.
I just ignored it.
Based off of perceived values that were very obvious in that experience.
Yeah, that was such a unique experience, too, that I'd worked on the show for a long time. Not a long time, but, like, I worked at CBC, I worked on that show, I'd, like, been around the show for a long time. Mm-hmm. I'd never once seen a pitcher get interrupted while they're doing their opening pitch. And so when I got interrupted, I was, like, shocked, you know? Literally doing my quick, like, 60-second monologue, and I got interrupted by someone being like, wait, stop, you know? And you're, like, completely confused as to what's going on. I had no idea what was going on, honestly. And then he was like, hey, you know, can model number 2 turn around? I'd love to check out her ass.
Insane.
It's so disrespectful.
Wild.
Do you know what I mean? Like, and so I just remember in that moment saying, like, it doesn't matter how much this person offers me or how high the valuation is, I will never take their money. Mm-hmm. I will never. Mm-hmm. And I think there's, like, you know, in business, I think you have to be principled. And I think if you want to work with good partners and have those partnerships last a long time, you have to lead with integrity.
Yeah. Are there questions that you find have been helpful to ask, you know, potential investors and partners that are really kind of like the barometer or kind of help understand what's the right relationship there?
Yeah, I think references are incredibly helpful. So talking to other founders and other people who have taken money from those firms or from those individual people, and figuring out how it went when times were good and when times were bad. I think understanding how funds work was, like, a huge unlock for me. Mm. So every fund, every institutional fund, every investor is a little bit different. But if you can be really clear on, you know, what's their risk appetite? How long do they typically hold investments for? You know, when do they start to get a little bit impatient about a return on their money or not? Like, what's their history like of sort of writing second checks or going in, you know, doubling down with the founders that they work with? And then what do they look for in founders and in partners, you know?
Yeah.
Even that alone, I think, can kind of tell you a lot.
If that's the right person.
Yeah.
What would you say is kind of like a misconception or something about running, like, a high growth business that no one really talks about these days, if you can name just one thing, not necessarily the biggest thing, but
that it gets easier.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. I think the bigger the business, the bigger the problems. And I've been at this for over 12 years, and it still shocks me. Like, I would have thought at a certain point things would have become quite a lot easier. Mm. And it's still hard.
Is it that?
And nobody wants to hear that.
Right.
Like, especially, I've seen that. Do you know what I mean? Like, people don't really want to hear from me that I think it's hard. Like,
and is it that the challenges are
bigger, more complex,
or different? Right.
Yeah, bigger and more complex, sometimes higher stakes, sometimes lower stakes. I mean, in the early days, you often have, like, everything personally riding on something. So, but I think it's just, and then the market, the world, everything is always changing.
Yeah.
So, like, the challenges are always going to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, speaking of everything changing, I just want to dip into a little bit of, like, what's happening from a current event standpoint, because the brand has a presence in the States internationally.
Yeah, totally.
How do the latest kind of discussions around kind of stuff like trade tariffs affect your business? And ideally also, what would you like to see, or how would you like consumers what would you like them to understand in terms of that discussion? Because there's probably a lot underneath the surface that people don't understand.
So for us, you know, about half our business is in the United States. So it is incredibly meaningful to us. Mm-hmm. I also can say without hesitation that we never would have had the success that we've had, the growth we've had, been able to accomplish what we have if we hadn't had the support of our Canadian audience and consumers. Mm-hmm. And so, and just to be clear, that doesn't mean you have to buy something from us. Mm-hmm. That might just mean that you, like, tell a friend or you share a campaign or you, like,
participate.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, when I look at what's happening right now and I look at the tariffs, like, we have a very direct hit that's happening on us. We're going to feel it. We have to come up with contingency plans that we're working through. A lot of other companies are in a similar position. And when I look at what we can do as a country, I mean, let's see if we can fight it. Like, I don't necessarily agree that we should be grouped in on this.
kind of just like, why are we here?
Why are we here?
Yeah.
A lot of conspiracies around that yes. like nobody wants to hear. But I think in the long run, I think Canada is going to be the best place to live.
Yeah.
I think if you like look at everything that's happening with climate change, and I think if you look at the maps of like where the most ideal place to live, it is the Great Lakes. It's like all centered around where most of Canada, where a lot of Canada is.
Yeah.
So I think there's like longer term objectives at play here. And I think the 51st state thing is real. I don't think it's a joke.
Yeah.
Like, and so what can we do in the interim? I'm just like such a big proponent of supporting Canadian. I think the best thing we can do is to continue to support Canadian brands, to have more success stories, to buy local, wherever you can. And if you can't buy, then share, you know?
Yeah. I will say that I think that that seems to be like a silver lining in that the dialogue around that's centering around supporting Canadian founded businesses or local businesses, the local economy. It's almost like reminds me of like pandemic era where it was like, let's help our neighbors and help our, you know, help Canadians.
Yeah.
And that has been nice to see
in
the face of everything going on, that there's been this really true kind of solidarity with each other to, you know, to support each other.
I agree. And I think there's a lot of folks and a lot of people who feel like incredibly motivated to try and like do what they can to make this place, make Canada thrive, you know, and make this be a great place to live and like continue to focus on what sets us apart.
Yeah. And even just the you know, if we're Canadian companies, and just also being able to kind of prioritize and or emphasize like interprovincial and just like
interprovincial our, trade is like a huge one. There's like a lot of red tape internally, you know, like there's just there are like very tactical things that we could do that could also just make it easier for us to do business within our own country.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Get out of our own way in some in some respects.
Yeah.
You know, Nix has always been rooted in inclusivity and diversity, and also just in the empowerment of women and people as well. You know, obviously there's a larger dialogue around women's autonomy and independence happening in the US and by extension in Canada, because everything that happens there has a ripple effect to us. And just kind of the overall regression in DEI initiatives, what responsibility do you think just brands have to reaffirm their values against kind of shifting tides in culture, and just kind of reestablish their values?
I think it's more important than ever. I mean, I think, you know, Nix was a brand that did these things before it was cool, before it was like expected or people were looking to us too. And, you know, we stood for something because we recognized that like when you build a brand today, it's about so much more than selling a product. Like, we are a media property in our own right as well. We have like a community and an audience that is listening. And, you know, I think that people want to see brands contribute and companies contribute and do good, right? And so I think that like for us, that was always part of our DNA.
It's been baked into your source code since the beginning.
Source code. And like we're actually just, you know, our biggest issue is that I think we do a lot and we don't even tell people what we do. Like there's companies that like say and then do. We are like a do and then say kind of organization. And so I think we need to do a better job of like actually championing all the things that we do. So that's just like an interesting one. Then I think, you know, a lot of companies felt pressure into doing things. And what I've noticed over the past, call it 8 weeks, is that all of a sudden there's been like kind of like a hall pass that says like, oh, you don't need to do this stuff anymore. And it's okay, you know? And so you're seeing a lot of people kind of be like, okay, cool. Like,
we good.
And so I think that's a little bit around some of the like corporate initiatives. when I look at, you know, broader changes around like women's rights and those different things, look, I think it's a disaster. Mm-hmm. I think it's a disaster. And I think, you know, for a lot of these pieces, people fought for a very long time to change things. And I think it's very, very scary to live in a world where we look at things going backwards. Mm-hmm. And I think it's like incredibly important that in Canada we hold on.
Yeah.
Like we don't have to follow everything. You know what I mean?
Do you think just by nature of like inherently of what you as a company do and the products you create and the messaging, the media that you create,
yeah,
that unintentionally, but maybe intentionally, like the brand is political just in the sense of
we
what
end
you
up being
for?
A little bit polarizing. Yeah. Like it's like we haven't done a good job with a TV commercial if like the Parental Association of Florida isn't writing us letters and telling us we're disgusting.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh my
like,
gosh.
Our brand campaign is not hitting it if someone doesn't like write us scathing emails saying that we're like, you know,
right,
should go out of business. So I think
and you can't
like
be everything to everyone.
You can't be everything to everyone. And I also, like, I don't actually think when we approach topics or we approach things as a brand, I don't think that there's, like, an ounce or a lick of hate in what we do. Mm-hmm. I actually think it's just a lot of optimism, information, education, and space. And so I think those are two different things. If you're going to be political and it's going to be rooted in hate, then you're going to hurt people, you know? Mm-hmm. If you're going to be progressive and challenging and try to open people's eyes to things, but do it from a place of optimism, openness, and heart, then I don't really think that someone can be mad at you.
Yeah.
And so we made a really intentional decision as a brand to do that. I remember it was during the Me Too movement and, you know, a lot of women-focused brands were pissed, you know? Like, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the truth is that, like, no one wants to stay angry for a very long time. And so we, you know, had a value at the time where we're like, we want to be an inspired protagonist. We want to show people a different way of thinking and a different way of being from a place of inspiration, not a place of negativity.
Right, right.
And that's
this is
conscious.
Different from like a toxic positivity.
Yeah,
aspect too,
it is
that's
different.
A different.
It's so different.
Too.
I think it's a great point. I think it's a great point. I think toxic positivity pretends that there aren't issues, mm-hmm. and that you can kind of like smile your way through it, you know what I mean? And everything's gonna be okay, you know? I think one of the benefits of being a brand that's been so centered on customer human-centric stories is that oftentimes what we have to do is we have to kind of like shine a light on our customers and our community and tell what's happening through them. Mm-hmm. And so that also gives us like a lot of leeway.
Yeah, experiences.
No one wants toxic positivity right now.
Yeah,
I don't think I so. I mean, maybe I'm wrong.
We're over it.
I think we're over it. Yeah.
You talk about, you mentioned that the brand, you know, there's things that the brand hasn't talked about that, you know, contribute to just like the overall culture of just doing before saying.
Yes.
So what are some of the things that you are proud of in terms of?
I mean, there's one example that I can think of where, you know, for the past couple of years, we had a really powerful partnership with this organization called BWHI, which is the Black Women's Health Imperative out of the U.S. And through that, we you know, have been donating proceeds from our maternity line for the past couple years and actually set up a whole new program where we provide bursaries to trained doulas of color. We then provide bursaries for families who otherwise can't afford care so that those doulas get paid to then go and provide access to care. And we've been doing this for 3 years and I think we've donated over $300,000 and we've trained like, I'm like looking at our teammate, but I like a lot of doulas, and we've provided care to like hundreds and hundreds of families, and you will barely read about that anywhere. Like that is just something that we've just been doing over and over again for the past few years. That we didn't like shout from the rooftops, if that makes sense.
Just leading by action.
Yeah. And also, you know, like trying to think a little bit differently about some of these programs we have where it's not just about writing a check, but it's about like developing a really cohesive program that has like a long-standing impact on the people who are now like in a new profession that they had wanted to get into, but otherwise maybe wouldn't have been able to afford the the courses, and better birth outcomes for the families who like otherwise wouldn't have been able to afford the care.
Yeah.
So I think it's like there's lip service and just writing checks, and there's like impact and meaning and actually creating holistic programs that truly make a difference.
Yeah, and like sustainable impact.
Yes, yes, exactly.
What would you say is an unpopular opinion that you have about your sector or just being a founder in general?
Okay, I don't know if it's unpopular or realistic, but from the seat I'm in, I think that body positivity is like on its way out as well. And so like the celebration and all the progress that we made around like diversity and body diversity, I think with Ozempic and all these different things, I think is like moving backwards.
Right, right.
Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
That is a big part of the, and so do you think that that's just tied to kind of what the, is happening politically or just in terms of the culture, like pop culture,
as well? Pop culture. I think it's pop culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting. Because Ozempic has been a phenomenal in terms of the pop culture zeitgeist and the dialogue. And it's like a noun to some people and like a verb to other people. Like it's really kind of been a part of every kind of household conversation at some point.
Yeah, no, it's true. And, and you see it in Fashion Week, you see it show up in like a bunch of different ways, just how it's like slowly starting to be less and less of a focus from a fashion standpoint.
So what's your, I guess as a brand, kind of your reaction to something like that, like just continue to stay the course?
Continue to stay the course, yeah. And to be clear, like I'm not against any of these things. It's like totally up to an individual if they want to do something with their body or like make a decision. Do you know what I mean? But I think it's, you know, kind of similar maybe to some of those other initiatives. It's like we just stay true. You know what I mean? Like keep on the course, right?
You know, speaking of staying on the course, so what do you, what are you most excited about in terms of the horizon or the road ahead for NYX as a brand?
Just so much work to get to do. I think just just feeling that we're like always just getting started. I'm excited about our continued expansion into retail, especially within Canada. So continuing to reach more folks through our retail stores, which is something I never thought I would be excited about, but here we are. I think we've got a ton of great products coming out this year. I think specifically within Active and Swim, we have like really, really great collections that we're launching. And so I'm excited to bring a different point of view than we've had previously. And then I think from a brand perspective, there's one thing we have on the slate. We've been in the process of helping co-fund our first documentary film. And so, yeah, really exciting. Yeah. And so you can read a little bit about it, but it's called The Pink Pill. And it's about women's sexuality and the female version of Viagra and just a whole conversation around like why we don't talk about that and you know what's going to happen there. So I'm like very excited to be dipping our toes into a different kind of media and to then help storytell around it.
Sorry, last few questions here. So if someone were to kind of follow your kind of blueprint for success or playbook for it, what's kind of like the one non-negotiable rule that you tell them to follow?
Don't give up.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like when everyone else would quit, like you got to pick yourself up and get back to it.
Yeah.
I'm like queen of allowing myself like one night to be angry. Like if something pisses me off, I actually think it's like incredibly therapeutic and helpful to like allow yourself a time limit on getting mad about it, getting it out of your system, and then getting back to work the next day. So I think that that's like another trait or blueprint that I've had historically since building NYX. I think a third would be attach yourself to something that's bigger than you, because it makes it a lot easier to not give up and to only be mad about something for an evening when what's motivating you to get out of bed is something that you feel like is so much more important than just your feelings. And then finally, I mean, blueprint, I like honestly try to have fun and every day's not fun and every moment's not fun, but I do try to like laugh and like not take it all so seriously all of the time.
Yeah.
Because I think like, oh, it's so cheesy. I'm going to say all these cheesy things. Like, it's about the journey, not the destination, but it really is.
Yes.
You know, yeah. And building a company, there is no overnight success story. It's showing up consistently every single day and doing the same thing over and over and getting a little bit better. And so I think knowing how long that takes, it's a lot easier when you actually enjoy the process.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah,
thank you
great.
So much.
You're
for
welcome.
That chat.
You're welcome.
So
yeah.
Many great insights.
That's a wrap on this episode of Mission Critical. If today's conversation gave you something to think about, do me a favor. Subscribe, leave a review, and share it with someone who needs to hear it. Big ideas are meant to be shared, and the best insights only matter if they're put into action. Until next time, stay sharp, stay curious, and go make something happen. I'm Lance Chung, and this is Mission Critical.